Here it comes, the latest people, trends, and news on sustainable living in and around our corner of the country. Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Down to Earth with Mrs. Green. We are going to put a wonderful spotlight on the Southwest for this show, and I certainly want to mention it is made possible due to the generous support of Discount Cab, aka Total Transit. We not only appreciate their support and everything they do to support Mrs. Green's work, but they do a lot for our planet because of their commitment to clean energy. So if you are looking for a cab, think Discount Cab, the little green Priuses that go all over the place and provide us with great transportation, all while using clean energy. So thank you, Discount Cab. The name of our show tonight is Felicia's Farm. And the guest for this show is Sophia Fourier Montes, who is the manager of Felicia's Farm. It's like a jewel in the desert. She has a great uplifting story to share with us about how a small group of dedicated individuals are addressing the issues of nutrition, health, and hunger for low-income and homeless people in our community. What greater service can there be? So, Sophia, thank you for coming, and let's hear the story.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about Felicia's Farm. How did it get started?
It started about 5 or 6 years ago. David Cutler is the owner of the farm, and his wife, Felicia Cutler, passed away from cancer in her honor, because she was always very passionate about feeding people and supporting her community. So in her honor, he started up the farm with the idea that he's going to donate everything that he gets from the farm and just give it straight to the people that need it the most, just to get, you know, her ideas out there and to let her live on in this way.
So first of all, farming is really hard work. Gardening is hard work. You have chickens, you have goats, you have produce. How much do you produce on this farm weekly? Do you have numbers for that?
It changes throughout the season.
Right.
We do about 100 dozen eggs a week on average.
That's a lot of eggs.
It's a lot of eggs. I think the number is 300 pounds of food a week on average, I think. But it really varies. Last month, for instance, we gave 1,000 pounds of food, you know, and that goes straight to a soup kitchen and gets distributed to people who really wouldn't have access to it otherwise.
So they're not only getting food donated, it's fresh, good, healthy food, right?
Yeah. If you've ever worked at a soup kitchen, you might see some of the donations that they get, which everything is appreciated, you know, they never turn anything down.
Right.
But a lot of the produce they get has been on the shelf for a while. You know, before it got to the shelf, it was shipped from who knows where. It's not exactly the freshest food, but we generally, like, I harvest in the morning and drive it over. So it's picked that day.
So are there any things, is there any time during the year when it's so hot? We're getting ready. Everybody in Tucson, Arizona has been thanking heaven that we had such a mild May, but it's coming. I mean, this week is the week it's supposed to start in the hundreds. Are there any weeks where you don't have anything, or do you just do seasonal appropriate crops that'll, you know, grow in the intense heat? Because there are some.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tucson is an amazing place because you can grow year-round. You might not be getting tomatoes in the high heat of summer.
I know. I hate that part.
Yeah. But you'll be getting squash. You know, you'll be getting some peppers. You'll be getting a lot of other stuff. We have melons. You know, they grow cantaloupes in Yuma. And that gets way hotter than here because they love the heat. They need the heat. I've actually been a little annoyed that it's been cool because my peppers just aren't doing much.
Because they need the heat.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny how it works that way? Well, all people in Tucson are very happy.
Yeah.
We'll just hope the peppers just spring forth in this
when
the
be
heat
okay.
comes. Okay. Well, we've had, and you said, I don't want to gloss over it, you distributed to one main soup kitchen?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the thing about when the farm started, they were like, well, you know, as we get bigger, we'll find other places to distribute, like, you know. But the thing about Casa Maria Soup Kitchen is they serve so many people like every single day that we haven't really had a need to find anywhere else. So we have one point where we drop off our food and they get it to hundreds of people. They donate 500 servings of soup a day, about 500 lunch bags where our eggs go, and then they give out 250 grocery bags, and this is all every single day except for like 2 days a year, you know?
Casa Maria
Soup Kitchen. You know, they're amazing. They work way harder than I do, honestly.
I doubt it if they're not out there in the sun. They're an amazing organization. I certainly don't want to minimize that. So we've had guests on the show like Gary Nabhan and Diana Liverman who talk about food deserts. Can you share with us some information that you have about food deserts and how what I believe is Felicia's Farm is actually a solution to the, you know, the very precarious position we get in since all of our food is driven in on trucks. Everything's shipped pretty much.
I mean, a food desert is a complicated thing. It's not just, oh, I don't have a grocery store here. It's people who are lower income who don't have access to transportation. It's lack of public transportation, you know. It's lack of healthy options that are easy because, let's be real, you know, if you're busy, you're working hard, you got a family, like, you're not going to go out of your way to drive an extra whatever miles to find a grocery store. Like, a lot of people just, that's just not an option.
Right.
So the great thing about Felicia's Farm and our partnership with Casa Maria is we take all this really amazing local food that you would normally just find in a farmer's market, you know, and would not be accessible. We take it and we put it exactly where people who are in need are already going.
And it's really good that you said that. It's Felicia's, right? I'm saying it the back east way. Felicia. It's Felicia. That's really, that's important to me.
I don't know. It might be Felicia. I'm Mexican,
I think it's
so.
Felicia. I think we should go with Felicia. We are in Tucson. I like that a lot. People often use the term sustainable food production. And that's another one where it's not just a simple definition. So take as much time as you want to describe to us that we do live in a desert. What does sustainable food production mean here versus what it would mean, say, in a place where it rains and there's a lot of green?
I mean, it's hard. We are not 100% sustainable yet. You know, maybe we won't ever be because of the nature of where we live. But I'm doing my hardest to close a lot of our, you know, outputs. Like, it's redirecting any so-called waste that you might have and putting it back as an input and just closing off those systems so that you are a contained kind of flow of matter, essentially. Our outputs are our veggies, you know. Our inputs would be like our feed for our animals and some straw. Water is a big one, you know.
So those are things that you have to still buy?
Yeah, still bring into
or
the farm.
Some other way.
That aren't made on there, yeah. But we get, we have 450 chickens and we have goats, so we have plenty of poop, which makes great compost.
Right, that's one of the cycles.
Yes, exactly, which, you know, makes the great veggies. And so in terms of water, we have a well. Something that I'm working on right now is implementing some kind of more permaculture ideas.
Right.
Earthworking the area, having basins. You know, when it rains, I really want not a single drop of water to fall off the property. I want all just to infiltrate down. Theoretically, I will be recharging the groundwater more than I'm pumping out. It's hard to tell because, you know, groundwater doesn't necessarily go down in a straight line. But I'm doing what I can in that way. And of course, we also use drip irrigation. We try to be very mindful of how much water we're applying, you know. So we try to be as efficient as possible in those ways.
What is your background that you're knowing to do these next steps? do you have a background in agriculture, or how do you know how to put all this to work?
Well, I got my undergraduate in crop production at the U of A, and then I went back and got my master's in environmental science, always with a focus in agronomy. But also during my time at the U of A, I connected with student organizations and I made friends with people who are, you know, more hippie-like, I guess.
We like that word. It's going to stay forever.
My friends and I actually helped establish the UA Community Garden that's on campus now. And, I now have friends who work with the habitat restoration who know about permaculture. We have conversations about, you know, how to produce tomatoes the best way and about EM. So it's all just been a kind of a cumulative, like, my interests as well as my education.
And it is a nonprofit.
Yes.
So you have to figure out ways for it to be sustainable. Is that part of the founding person's contribution to keeping the farm going? Or do you sell things? Or do you get donations? What's the funding mechanism?
I mean, David really wants everything to be donated. He doesn't care about profit, you know?
Right.
Because he's he just donates a lot of his income. You know, he's a very generous person.
What a commitment to our community.
Yeah.
I mean, major kudos to him.
Yeah, it's inspiring.
It's very inspiring.
Yeah. We also have a grant writer. So, you know, we try to find funding because we don't want him to pay for everything. That's a lot.
Right.
So we do want to be more financially sustainable. We're always applying for grants. You know, we're always trying to find ways that we can do something that's not necessarily selling a product.
And what about like with rainwater harvesting, which you alluded to, I thought I saw on your Facebook page, did someone just donate a big tank?
Yeah.
So a community organization, that's a big plus.
Yes. Yes. That was delightful. He read our article on the Arizona Daily Star and he just thought to himself, oh, I have this big tank I'm not really doing anything with. I bet they could use it. And he came by and asked me and I was like, sure. So yeah, we have this 750 gallon tank. It was donated by Johnny from Johnny's Electrical. He couldn't use it because it's too tall, but we're going to use it for our chicken coop probably.
That's great.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's great.
Yeah.
So how many chickens did you say you had?
We have, I believe it's 450. The number might have gone up recently.
That's a lot of tending.
Oh yes.
Too.
Yes. Really? And so I'm the vegetable person.
Right.
Luis Altamirano is our livestock manager. So he knows everything you could ever know about chickens, and he's the one that's in charge of managing them and feeding them and collecting the eggs, and he does a crazy amount of work in that regard.
And who's in charge of the goats?
It's kind of a mutual thing. Like, we're all kind of helping out, you know. He definitely is the most knowledgeable for them, so
right.
I defer to him in a lot of things. But for instance, over the weekend, like last week, we have a bottle baby. Her mama rejected her, so we're feeding her with a bottle. So last weekend, I took her home, you know, this past weekend.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, this past weekend, Luis and Danny, our farmhand, like, helped feed her while I was gone. Like, it's... We just kind of have to have each other's backs.
It's a community.
Sense. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's really a community. How often did the baby goat have to be fed?
Well,
is it like having a baby in the house?
I spoiled her and I fed her every time she started crying at me.
But that's generally, what I did with my own kids.
Yeah. But generally, it's about 4 times a day. And then it goes less as she gets older and starts nibbling on actual food.
Okay.
Yeah.
And she's going to make it.
Yeah, she's fine. She's
that's
the spoiled
really, really
farm
good.
Rat now.
And then do you do anything with the milk?
Right now, we're not doing much. The babies are just drinking all because we had
right,
a lot of
right,
births recently.
Right.
David would like to make cheese, but that's not... He's going to donate it, but it's not necessarily going to be under the farm.
Right.
So the goats are in kind of a gray area in that they're on the farm, but they're paid for by him.
And goats are crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had people on the show, and my husband as well, telling me goats are... They can get anywhere. They can get into anything. So have they been a nuisance at times?
I mean, the reason we had a bunch of births is because we had a buck who figured out how to open the gate with his horn. So we found him in the other pens, and we're like, oh.
Uh-oh, we're going to be having babies this spring.
Yep, pretty much.
That's hysterical.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. They're so clever.
They are. They're very
clever. I've watched things about goats, and boy, it's hard to keep them out of things, even if you have high fences.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
figure it out a lot. They really make me laugh. So when you do something, we want to clarify, too, from what you've implied, everything's organic?
Yes.
Organic,
yes.
That's great. That's really, really great. So do you use other, like, pests to control things, and what do you do? Because there are trouble that you have, challenges if you're
yeah.
not spraying.
I mean, it's my first year here, so I'm still getting the feel of the area. What I do want to do is install a pollinator hedgerow to encourage like local pollinators, and it brings in beneficial insects, which will hopefully bring, you know, the
natural, what I call them the natural predators.
Yeah, exactly.
That are the bigger bugs that are or birds that are going to eat the smaller things.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm playing with the idea of planting more sunflowers between the beds because the birds like them and they'll hang out in them. And I'm hoping they'll go and eat grasshoppers.
That's great.
You know?
That's really great.
They might also eat my tomatoes, but that's just kind of the give and take, you know. And yeah, the most I spray is like soapy water. You know, I might buy some neem oil if things get really bad.
Right.
But in the future, I'm working on, like, I'm playing with the ideas of getting guinea hens to live on the field and eat any insects.
That's
you know,
right? They will just go and eat them up.
Yeah, yeah. But that's you know, it's all these projects and ideas I have for the future. Right now, it's just me trying to whack any grasshopper I see and spraying soapy water on you know.
The natural
plans.
Water, yeah,
yeah,
it's really good. I mean, it's to me, that's the holistic approach. People just don't understand that when
yeah.
you spray the pesticides on the plants, they go in them and then it goes down into the water and it's just a nasty thing to
well, that's also
think
the,
about.
Like the whole idea of like you know, more permaculture, like long-term sustainability, is we have an excess of insects, and birds like insects, so let's have birds that will eat those insects, you know, and not necessarily feed the birds anything extra. Like, it's all about finding a balance. If you have an excess of something, try to find it where you can use it for something else.
Right, and the circle of life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really not going out of that and introducing something really artificial.
Yeah.
So I can think of ways that Felicia's farm positively impacts our community. It's kind of like a pebble in a pond when you do something like feed the hungry. Can you talk about that, the positive impacts besides just feeding hungry bellies?
I mean, it also comes from when you're just going through a really tough time, you know, it helps to have a good meal. You know, it helps to be able to eat something that just really feels nourishing, that isn't, you know, one of those honey cakes or anything that's in a box. You just don't do well if you don't feel like you're putting good things into your body. And that can be, that wears people down, you know, providing people with this fresh fuel, like, and with ingredients that we, you know, a lot of the neighborhoods we serve are Latino and Black, like ingredients that are culturally relevant to them.
Right.
You know,
things that they really want to eat.
Yeah. That they look at and like, oh, I can make this dish that my mom used to make, or, you know, I know how to cook with this. Like, nothing that they'll look at and be like, oh, it's something we're working on. It's, you know, we had too much eggplant last year. They didn't really like that too much. So I'm trying to find more of a variety, like things that they really enjoy to make, and that it's not just fuel for your belly. It's fuel for your soul. You know, you feel good.
That's really important.
Yeah, it
is. I mean, it's nourishment in the biggest sense of the word. I would think, having a background in social services, that another ripple effect would be it probably leads to people getting jobs and getting out of homelessness, because you can't focus on a healthy, holistic life if you're hungry.
Absolutely.
And if your kids are hungry.
Oh, yes. I mean, if I get a little bit hungry, I get grouchy and mean, you know, and that's over just like an hour. I can't imagine. I'm very lucky that I can't imagine, because I've been blessed in my life, but I don't know how people can function when they're hungry. Like, you can't concentrate.
They can't.
You know,
they can't learn.
You don't have energy to go out and try something. Like, you just don't. It's exhausting. And if we can avoid, you know, anybody having to go through that with what we're donating, that's great. That's a
and
big
I know
impact.
That there, to me, I'm so proud to be in Tucson. We have a lot of what I call thought leaders and innovators. The Community Food Bank is trying to produce much more fresh, locally grown food, and their community gardens and their kitchens that they're teaching people how to cook. So I think their leadership is really trying to be more than just the distribution of packaged foods.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I volunteered at Las Milpitas when I was an undergrad, and that really, like, inspired me. You know, it's such a beautiful place. And it's not just that they're growing this good food, but, you know, they'll go out and help you plant a garden in your backyard. And that's amazing for food security, because you don't have people having to leave their house anymore. You have them in their backyard picking their veggies and, you know, feeding themselves in that way. And that's amazing. Like,
and to me, it would be very hard for me to get everything from the garden. But if you're eating a lot of your food that's fresh and doesn't have pesticides, it contributes to a healthier community. That's a big impact to me.
Yeah.
It's less disease and less contamination and just overall a better good health.
I mean, I've wanted to be a small farmer for years now. You know, it's what I hope to eventually have my own farm. But I always think that the more people I am able to feed with this kind of produce that's local and, well, you know, made responsibly, the less they'll go out and buy produce from other sources, which has a lot of bad things in it, not just pesticides, but, you know, there's labor rights and violations.
Social justice
and,
issues.
It's just,
totally.
There's so many things tied into that it's if I can feed anyone with something that's not that, I think that's already great.
And I love that you bring it up, because to me, that's part of a sustainability movement, is when you incorporate social justice. It's an integral part. I mean, I could not agree with you more.
Yes.
Know your farmer. Make sure your farmer wasn't locked up at night. That doesn't happen, I don't believe, in the United States, but in a lot of countries where we import things from, they lock their slaves, that's what I call them. They may pay them, but they lock them up at night so they can't escape.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, in Mexico, like, you have a lot of foreign companies coming in and growing things in a way that's not just detrimental to the environment, but hurts a lot of the people there.
Like, truly,
you know,
truly.
It's hard. And that's where most of our tomatoes come from, you know? It's hard to escape. You want a tomato and you don't think about it when you're at the grocery store, but it's
but they're
everywhere.
Not very good. And that's one of the things where I think, even with the proliferation of farmers markets, if you go to a farmer's market and start buying your tomatoes there, you pretty much can't eat tomatoes when they're not in season, at least for me, because they don't. It tastes like a whole different vegetable or fruit. I think tomatoes are fruit. It just like, if I can't get them there and get some really good beefsteak or whatever they are, I don't want any tomatoes. It tastes like rubber.
Yeah, but that also comes from a lot of, you know, we have the option to say that, but some people...
Exactly. You know, they can't. It's the only thing. It's what is available.
I mean, so. I have a hard time shopping at the farmer's market still because I'll spend my whole paycheck.
That's exactly right. Yes, it is the cost part. But you always know when something's in season because it's a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to look for. I mean, even at Whole Foods the other day, a huge bunch of kale was 99 cents. I'm like, okay, kales must be really rocking it. You know, I love to ask people like you that obviously have such a passion and a commitment to what you're doing. What do you have a couple of Kodak moments that you've had on the farm since you started, or are you just there's just really great stuff every day?
I mean, it kind of is every day, you know. But I think the moments that I love the best are the ones where I can really see just the amazing potential of people power, which I think we underestimate a lot. But you know, just I'll have this big project and I'll think to myself, like, man, I'm gonna wait for a group to come in.
How am I gonna do this?
I'm gonna wait for a group to come in. They can work on it all day and it'll be fine. And then the group comes in, they finish it in an hour or two, and they're like, we're done. What else is there? What do you want us to do? And I'm just like, oh my gosh,
that's awesome. So how does a group like that hear about you? I'm thinking you've got to come present to my Rotary Club because that's the people. There are people that are looking for ways to do good things in the community.
I mean, the bigger groups are definitely like, we'll have a business who, like Intuit's been coming out.
Awesome.
They'll have volunteer hours. You know, we've had people from the Air Force. We've had people from Citibank, from just different kind of places of employment that encourage their... That
give their employees volunteer hours. That's great.
And then it's great because you already have a big group that's got a lot of camaraderie. You know, they work together. They know each other. And so it's fun for them to come out and do something a little different. And they tell me they have fun, but they seem to have a blast.
I'm sure they're having fun. It's like, or they wouldn't come back.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, I just spoke at the Greater Tucson Leadership graduation last week or the week before, and their project, you know, it's a year-long participation in this, and their project was to put in, to totally redo a space at one of the, I think it was the Pascua Yaqui schools, and it was amazing what they did. And they really had fun, and they did a lot of work in a short amount of time, a lot of intensive labor, but they transformed the school garden. Really amazing.
I mean, if you have enough people, the labor doesn't even seem that bad, you know. You work hard, but it doesn't feel like overwhelming.
Right, and it's better to do it before June.
Yes, yes.
Things like that. People have more fun outside before June.
Or at least early in the morning.
Early in the morning, that's true. It's still okay.
Yes.
Do you have, in addition to the, you said you have several paid staff, which I would think would have to ensure the success of the farm. But do you have regular volunteers, people that show up every day, or they're there every Thursday or once a week?
Yeah. And the farm wouldn't be possible without them. It's nice to be able to be like, okay, you know, it's Tuesday. I can expect this person to probably come. I don't like to hold anybody to anything. I know life happens. I don't want them to feel like it's a job. So they just come when they feel like it, you know. But I can usually rely on them for a couple days a week. And yeah, we have a great core of volunteers who just... They decide, I'm going to spend my day sweating and being outside and working hard.
Doing some really, like, dirty jobs.
Yeah.
I just mean, like, you really get dirty.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of things with composting and chicken poop. And
I mean, it's definitely not for everybody. On Friday, I had somebody come out, and then I asked him, like, oh, you're going to come back? And he's like,
I don't think
so. And I was like, that's fine. And I get it. I totally get it. But the people that do like it, they come out and they shovel poop with me and they get real dirty and they do weeding in the hot sun. And at the end, they just feel very fulfilled and they look at a row of, you know, a clean row that doesn't have a bunch of weeds in it and they feel very happy with themselves.
Really touching with the earth.
Yeah.
Really, that's really cool. What happens when a volunteer does show up? Are they assigned to one person and are they supervised? And do you keep them busy? Because I think the worst thing for a volunteer is to show up and not have enough to do.
That doesn't happen with us.
There's always some jobs.
Oh, yes. I'm generally there. So I'm generally the one that's dealing with or engaging with volunteers, you know. So usually I just have them help me. because it makes my work easier to have someone with me. I'll be like, okay, we're going to weed this bed. And then I hang out with them.
And you have a big list.
Yeah. Or if I have a bigger group, like I might put some people on one thing and then somebody on another thing. If I'm not there, because sometimes I'm out doing deliveries or running errands, there is a chalkboard that we have like tasks on. It can be a little hard to understand if you're not there already. You know, like if you aren't familiar with the farm, you might not know what onion bed I'm talking about. But it's helpful for people who are regulars who show up and don't even have to check in with me. They just look at the chalkboard and they just go out and do what needs to be done.
That's a lot of work. Even when you're talking about it, it's like running a farm is a lot of work, and you want to have your own small farm someday, which makes me admire the heck out of you. So besides the need for human power and volunteers continuing that, what other kind of ongoing or pressing needs do you have? Do you have a wish list?
Yeah. It's generally just supplies. You know, we could always use more tools. Like those inputs I talked about, you know, straw or, things like that, seeds. Those are always appreciated. But honestly, mostly it's just help, you know.
Human power.
Yeah, just people coming out and helping. Like everything else is pretty well covered, but I can have as many compost piles as I, you know, want, but it's about turning them. And that's when I need the support.
I just keep shaking my head and saying it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
It's so much fun.
It is. I mean, you can tell you're happy.
Yeah.
It's fulfilling work. It's definitely seeing the product very quickly after you invest in the output to make it happen. And you know that you're feeding people every day. What about your dream for the farm? What are some of the things that you'd like to see happen as you continue to grow? And what does the magical Felicia's farm look like? Sounds to me it's magic already.
What I really want is for people to come out and see it and be like, oh, this is not what I thought a farm was like at all, you know? And just to have it totally turn the idea of food production on its head. Like, it doesn't have to be a giant acre of corn or a giant acre of lettuce or whatever, you know? It can be this kind of messy, organic kind of way of doing it. Like, things don't always turn out, but when they do, they taste so much better, you know? And I don't know. I want it to be an educational space, like a place for inspiration. And I want it to be like an example, something that sets precedent of like, this is another way we can produce food here, you know?
And maybe even see others do it.
I mean,
it's really, we could use more of them, that's for sure. But that's a really generous way to get it started. What are some of the biggest challenges other than labor? Is it the weather? Is it the goats eating the vegetables? What kind of big challenges where you just want to shake your head and say, oh no, not again? Do you have those?
Yeah, we have... the bunnies, oh, they're so cute.
The bunnies, oh my gosh.
I fix up a hole in the fence and I make another one, and they love my green beans, not the plant, the actual green beans. Like, they'll go in and just harvest them themselves.
The bunnies.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, you know, like some things with any kind of farm, there's a challenge of like, oh, this is getting really hit hard by something that's nibbling on it, you know.
That's a big challenge.
Yeah.
I'm Peter Rabbit.
Exactly. I'm the bad guy in Peter Rabbit. I'm the gardener.
Okay. We have about 2 minutes left, and I want to make sure that I think the best way for people to find you is on Facebook. Is that correct?
Yes. We're working on getting a website launched.
Would be good.
Yeah. We're getting a proper website. I know that's been lacking. Right now, Facebook is definitely where you put stuff. I have an Instagram account, which I will need to relink to the Facebook, where I just post pictures from the farm and, you know, every other day have something new for a more up-to-date thing.
I love Instagram.
Yeah.
It's the one social media thing in Mrs. Green's world that I do myself. I just love it because a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Absolutely.
And it's in the moment and it's now. So that's good, Instagram. And the Facebook page is Felicia's Farm.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
It's simple to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, how do people find you? Like, how did Intuit know to come and get you?
Oh, I think we're on like Volunteer Match. Like,
oh,
we're on,
yes, you
know,
you are.
We're on a couple of sites like that.
You are.
Yeah.
So that's really another service that I think is great. Well, Liz, I'll tell you what. I don't know about you, but I think the time flew. Everybody, if you just tuned in, I'm sure you're going to want to re-listen to the entire podcast. But joining us today is Sophia Fourier Montes, who is the manager of Felicia's Farm in Tucson, Arizona. And it's like River and Alvernon,
mm-hmm.
real close to the JCC. Most people in Tucson know where that is.
Yeah.
So it's across from that.
North side of River.
Like, and people, I hope people will find you. Everybody, thanks for being a part of our Down to Earth series. Don't forget about Mrs. Green's Sustainers program to help us keep bringing programs like this, the Igloo app, and next week on May 30th, Mary Nickel with Greenpeace about shell drilling plans in the Arctic. A tough show to listen to, but one we all better. Thank you. Make it a great green week.